This is 15 Minute History, a podcast for educators, students, and history buffs featuring the minds and talents of the University of Texas at Austin. 15 Minute History is a partnership of Not Even Past and Hemispheres in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin.
Welcome back. Hi, this is 15 Minute History. I'm Henry Winsek, graduate student of history here at UT and assistant editor at Not Even Past. And today I'm speaking with James Vaughn, an assistant professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. He studies the history of Britain and the British Empire in the late 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. And his current project re-examines the American Revolution as an international and imperial event. Welcome, Professor Vaughn.
Thank you, Henry, and thanks for having me here at 15 Minute History.
Our pleasure. So just last week, our nation celebrated the 4th of July, the consummately national event commemorating our successful revolution against British colonial rule. But you're here to argue that we should not regard July 4th, 1776 as a strictly national moment of history, but rather a global one that reflects questions of politics, economics, and ideas that transcend national boundaries. And one particularly important international context for this moment was the British Empire. So can you talk about the state of Britain's empire before 1776 and how the 13 colonies fit into that?
Sure. That's a great question. To kind of coin a phrase, my main interest is deprovincializing the American Revolution. Mm. Now, of course, the 13 colonies that revolted in 1775 were 13 provinces of a wide British Empire, and it was a revolt of essentially British provincials on the far western edges of that empire. But what often is missed in the American Revolution and the story of the development of the British Empire is it didn't just purely take place within an internal context of either colonial North America or the British Empire, but really in a transnational, transatlantic context of the development of commercial and manufacturing society. Long story, very, very short. Traditional agrarian civilization had begun to break up in areas of northwestern Europe in the 14th and 15th century. And in key places such as the Netherlands and England and other areas of northwestern Europe by the late 17th and 18th centuries, that traditional agrarian civilization had begun to be replaced with a commercial and manufacturing society. Now, there wasn't really multiple commercial and manufacturing societies. Rather, there was an interdependent cosmopolitan commercial manufacturing society that stretched from places like Lyon and Marseille all the way to London and Bristol, across the Atlantic to New York and Philadelphia and Boston. And that was a profoundly interdependent society in which people produced and worked and exchanged the products of their labor in an ever more complex division of labor and an ever wider market with one another. And that the British Empire was fundamentally bound up with the development of that transatlantic commercial and manufacturing society. It was both cause of that society to be able to rise, the founding of those colonies, the development of raw materials and staple products to be produced and sent back to Europe from those colonies, also the development of those colonies as markets for manufactured goods that were produced in Europe. And these were important to the rise of that commercial manufacturing society. But it's also the case that the British Empire drew its strength from the development of that commercial manufacturing society, meaning the British Empire drew its revenues, its customs, its resources from the flourishing of that empire. So by the middle of the 18th century, a very symbiotic relationship had developed, where the British Empire furthered the development of an ever more expansive transatlantic commercial and manufacturing society and directed the development of that, but also benefited from its development in terms of the taxes and the revenues and the resources levied on the goods and commodities exchanged throughout that empire. So it's a very beneficial relationship.
You've touched on a really interesting dynamic, this transatlanticism, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, within the British Empire. How did that impact the way in which American colonists interacted or thought about other British colonists, for instance, in places like India and Ireland?
So that is a very excellent question, because there's a sort of a complexity to the way that American colonists think about their relationship. In many respects, the conception of the American colonists was that they were like British subjects within England and Scotland and Wales itself. That is, that they were direct subjects of the British crown, right? And that they had their own little parliaments, just like England and Scotland and Wales had the parliament sitting in London. And they viewed the extension of British trade and the extension of British colonies as also being about the extension of British laws and British rights. So they very much viewed themselves as a kind of Britain West. And they thought that their legislatures, again, this is by the mid-18th century, had the kind of status that the Parliament had within Britain itself, and that they were direct subjects of the crown and had all the traditional privileges and rights thereof. Now, in the context of when they begin to debate with imperial officials, particularly in the 1760s, there is a desire to both assert their traditional privileges and rights as British subjects, but they also begin to assert the natural rights, right? And this is not reducible merely to an inherited British discourse of rights, but this is rather a transatlantic Enlightenment discourse. So there's a complexity to the imperial relationship because they think of themselves as full British subjects with all the rights and privileges that metropolitan Britons have.
Can you talk about that a little bit more, these Enlightenment ideas that transcend national boundaries? Could you explain a little bit what those ideas are forwarding and also what role they played in the British Empire?
Sure. So let me address the Enlightenment first. It's commonplace to say things like the Scottish Enlightenment or the French Enlightenment, or people speak of a Neapolitan Enlightenment, but I would reject that. I think that there's just one Enlightenment, and it's about anyone who has access to it that can read either the original languages or translations of ideas circulated in pamphlets and newspapers and debate and reflect on them in a coffee house, in a public square, in a tavern. What becomes really central to that Enlightenment is a sense in which people begin to feel that they're responsible for the creation of their own world. That's a complex idea. Let me concentrate on two thinkers, both of which were very important to the American colonists, John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, both kind of classic thinkers in the social contract Enlightenment tradition. John Locke had fundamentally said that the basis of the polity should be life, liberty, and property. Now, what he defined property as was labor, nature transformed by labor. So within Locke's conception, there essentially emerged an idea that human beings created property, that property was not divinely ordained, that property was not things that people had innately in them, such as aristocrats having the property of being honorable and noble, but rather that property was something that came into being through individual endeavor and people's collective endeavor to one another, and that people transformed the world and themselves and created claims to property in so doing. And so Locke gave a sense of the world as a product of human interaction, humans working together individually and collectively to transform the world around them. And Rousseau, particularly with The Social Contract and the Second Discourse on Inequality, published in the 1750s and 60s, gave the idea of men and women as really products of societies they built, right? That there's not an immutable essence, but rather that men and women change over time, given the kind of societies and historical frameworks they develop themselves. So what's really important about the Enlightenment, which takes place roughly from the late 17th to the late 18th century, and is really the fundamental background of the American Revolution, is a growing sense through Lockean ideas of property being a product of labor and Rousseauian ideas of the social contract and men and women responsible for the creation of their own societies over time. There comes a sense not simply that human beings change, but that human beings can be agents of their own change. And the only other thing I want to say about the Enlightenment is that it wasn't just an intellectual accomplishment. It was a social fact. What I mean by that is because of the rise of commercial manufacturing society, there were new urban spaces. There was an entire extra parliamentary, extra official political culture that existed in the world of coffee houses, in the world of taverns, in the world of theater, in the world of public discussions and the exchanges and marketplaces of Amsterdam, of Rotterdam, of Charleston, of Philadelphia, of Bristol, of Liverpool. And in that world, people came together and discussed the latest publications and debated ideas. And it wasn't noble people of blood or birth that won out, but rather it was people who could persuade others that their ideas were right that won out.
It seems to me an interesting irony of this period in history is that, you know, the American Revolution was not an inevitable fact. And in reality, a lot of individuals like Thomas Paine and Benjamin Franklin prior to 1776 were not advocating for independence from Britain, but reform within the British Empire. Can you explain a little bit how their thinking evolved?
A very famous historian, Gordon Wood, of American history, calls this process the Americanization of Benjamin Franklin. And I think it applies to a whole host of the revolutionary generation, as much to people like Jefferson and Adams as to people like Paine and Franklin. And what it is these fundamentally Enlightenment men and women who participate in a world of pamphlets, of coffee house, of lawyerly suits, parliamentary debate, of discussion. These people that also argued in salons and debating societies. Many people, not just British subjects, thought of the freest society in not just the West, but indeed the world in the middle of the 18th century being the British Empire. Many people thought that, with the possible exception of the Netherlands, the British Empire was the most religiously tolerant society. Even though it had an established Church of England, it had de facto an incredible proliferation of not just Protestants, but even non-Christian religiosity. And that it had a parliamentary system that, although very few people could vote in, that nevertheless gave relative transparency to government and was based on elections every 7 years, and people could riot and influence the electors. Furthermore, it had ended absolute monarchy, that the English Revolution of the 17th century had brought divine right monarchy to an end, right? And suggested that there has to be some kind of consent and some degree of representation in political affairs. Now, people thought the British Empire was the best embodiment of that. And especially someone like Franklin, and especially somebody like a young Thomas Paine, were absolutely supporters of Britain's wars against France because they saw France as an alternative model. An absolute monarchy with an intolerant Catholic Church and not allowing the same kind of freedom of discussion and association that the British world did. In fact, one of the greatest French philosophers of the 18th century, Voltaire, wrote his philosophical letters as a reflection on his time in England and how much open and freer society it was and how much he viewed it as a model of the future of Europe. Now, what happens in the 1750s and 60s is in the wake of the Seven Years' War and the imperial reforms and the coming confrontation between metropolitan ministers and officials and radical figures like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine, what begins to happen is there is initially a movement for the reform of the British Empire, the desire that it change. There's a growing feeling that this empire and its political and social institutions are no longer adequate to the kind of new world that's coming into being in the 18th century Atlantic. But at first they want reform. They want changes. They want things like the reform of Parliament, the expansion of the franchise, the inclusion of new groups in the right to vote. They want the colonial legislatures to have a say in producing colonial policy, or they want imperial parliament, the colonies to be able to send representatives to London and sit in the parliament. Hence the famous war cry or revolutionary cry of no taxation without representation. They move towards reform. It's only when they believe that reform is no longer possible that Britain is irredeemably, in their view, aristocratic and oligarchic, that they come to the conclusion of no possibility of reform, but rather necessity of revolution, necessity of break. And that is the seabed of American independence. But it should be said that it was an incredibly difficult intellectual and personal process for people like Thomas Paine and Benjamin Franklin to come to those conclusions. They genuinely thought that for all of its foibles, the British Empire, for all of its exploitation of Ireland, for all of its toleration of the existence of West African slavery, for all of its incredibly oligarchic politics, that it nevertheless had been the best heretofore vehicle of the expansion of human prosperity and enlightenment and freedom. And so it really took a very long and complex and difficult process for them to be willing to reject it.
So it sounds like you're suggesting that this really wasn't a situation in which it was America versus Britain. It was two people within the empire debating how that empire ought to be run. Can you point to any other places within the British Empire in which a similar debate was taking place?
Yes, that's an excellent point, that it should not be seen as mother country versus colony or American versus British, but rather debate taking place throughout the British Empire about what the future of the British Empire is. And that debate involved people and ideas that were not just British, but beyond the boundaries of the British Empire, from across the Atlantic world and indeed beyond the Atlantic world. A good example to sort of answer your question is that around the same time that the colonial resistance movement is beginning in the 1760s and the revolution breaks out in 1774 and 1775 is also the period of the origins of the British Empire in India. And principally in northeastern India, in the richest province in the Mughal Empire, Bengal. In Bengal, the East India Company has become a sovereign power. It's transformed from a commercial corporation to a sovereign state. And the British are confronting British ministers, officials, merchants, how to govern this new empire. And there's actually debates in Calcutta and debates in the boardrooms of the East India Company on Leadenhall Street in London and debates in Parliament over how this empire should be governed. And many people are arguing that this empire needs to be free and open, that there has to be free trade in India, that to some degree, British subjects and Asian subjects and indigenous subjects have to be included in processes of governing, that colonists have to be sent out so Europeans and Asians can mix and create a cosmopolitan society. But ultimately, that position loses out. And the position that wins out in the boardrooms of the East India Company and in the committee meetings of the East India Company in Calcutta and in the British political classes, this create a more authoritarian empire where a small British bureaucratic and military cadre through a largely indigenous sepoy army govern in a despotic fashion these vast territorial acquisitions in northeastern India and pump out land revenues from those acquisitions. And this kind of development reverberates throughout the empire. That is, there are people in Ireland, there are people in Virginia, there are people in Massachusetts deeply disaffected by this kind of authoritarianism brewing in India. And in fact, a lot of scholars read this wrong because a lot of scholars point out that, oh, look at all of these American pamphlets making references to Nawabs or Nizams in India and how they refuse to be like that. And scholars read this as some kind of ethnocentrism or even some suggest sort of racism or orientalism, which it isn't at all. What they're actually suggesting is that the kind of empire that's being built in British India doesn't carry the kind of rights and representation and political transparency that the empire has carried elsewhere. And they fear that this might be a new form that will come to them. And so invariably, colonial radicals interpret increasingly authoritarian and increasingly militaristic and increasingly bureaucratic British imperial measures in North America, like the Quartering Act, like the Stamp Act, like the Intolerable Acts, as part of a spirit, a new spirit of imperialism that it's manifesting itself even more strongly in British India, in Bengal, with this despotic authoritarian military state that's being set up. And so you get people in America saying, we will not be Nawabs. And they don't mean anything orientalist by it. What they mean by it is we will not accept despotic governors that rule above our society instead of in collaboration with and through our society.
So it sounds like what you're suggesting is that the American Revolution was not as unique and national as we like to believe it, but in fact, part of a larger and very ordinary debate that was taking place within the empire as a whole.
That's absolutely right. And it was a debate that was informed not just by ideas that were brewed in the empire, but brewed in this wider cauldron of a transatlantic world of the Enlightenment and of the public sphere and of new urban forms of sociability. And that's exactly right. And there are two questions at the heart of the American Revolution. The first question is, what is the future of the British Empire, right? And it's not that it's the British and the Americans have different answers to that. Rather, some conservatives and reactionaries have one set of answers to the future of the British Empire, and some radicals have another set of answers to the future of the British Empire. And it happens to be that the conservatives and reactionaries win out in the metropolis. They win out in the mother country. They win out in Britain. And they also win out in India. But they lose out in North America. But because the conservatives and reactionaries win out in the commanding heights of the British Empire, in London itself, it becomes necessary for the radicals to break from the British Empire, right? Really, I mean, if I could just stay on this point a bit, the colonial resistance movement does not view itself in isolation. It emerges at almost exactly the same time as Wilkesite and parliamentary reformist movements in Britain in the 1760s. There's a wide sense of the British imperial state, both at home and abroad, being inadequate to the new commercial and enlightened and manufacturing world of the mid to late 18th century. And there are many people, not just the colonial planters, lawyers, doctors, merchants of North America, but also middling sort and plebeian groups, artisans, shopkeepers, middling merchants in Britain itself demanding reform, the transformation of political institutions so as to make them more responsive to, more representative of this new kind of society that civil society has developed and changed, and now the state and the political institutions have to be more responsive and more representative of it. And the cry of no taxation without representation is as much a cry of Wilkesites and reformers and members of the society, the supporters of the Bill of Rights, the SSBR, one of the first major organizations of parliamentary reform that's founded in 1760s Britain. That's as much of their cry as it is colonial radicals. And so this was really a pan-British cry, but it was also a cry taking place in the transatlantic world. It was a cry taking place by radical enlightenment and patriot figures in Rotterdam, in Amsterdam, in Paris, in Lyon, in Naples, in Geneva, all over this world. So really, that's what's at stake. Fundamentally, if you could put it this way, the American Revolution was about three things. First, it was about the democratization of the British state. It was part of a broader movement across the whole empire, and indeed across much of the Atlantic, for democratization, and particularly democratization of the British state. And that question, would the British state be democratized? Here, I mean democracy in the 18th century sense, not necessarily in our sense, right? Would the British state be democratized? Opened a second question was, what was the future of the British Empire? And behind all of these other things was this profound question of, were the political forms of the 18th century Atlantic world adequate to the kind of new society that had come into being in that world?
So given this new interpretation of the American Revolution that you're proposing, that it's a real transatlantic imperial moment as much as a national one, how would you describe the meaning of the American Revolution?
The preface I'll say to giving a meaning to the American Revolution is, I really think the American Revolution should be, as you said, seen as part of this wider transatlantic process. I really think that it should be seen as part of an age of revolution, and not an age of revolution that begins in 1789 or even begins in 1776, but rather an age of revolution that begins in the 1750s and 60s, when the old regime, including both the absolute monarchies of France and Austria and the British parliamentary system, begin to experience a lot of crisis and upheaval. And these crises and upheavals could have been transcended. They've been transcended before. But this time they weren't transcended. In fact, they opened up processes of revolutionary change. And these processes of revolutionary change gave birth to the Constitutional Republic or the Democratic Republic. And the essence of that process was that, unlike prior political revolts, it wasn't simply the case that you could make adjustments to the existing political system, as the Glorious Revolution had did, by taking one part of that political system, the traditional parliament, and raising it to a supremacy over the monarchy and ending absolute monarchy. That was an incredibly important change that the Glorious Revolution introduced. But the American Revolution was part of this wider revolutionary epoch, stretching from the 1760s to the 1840s. The fundamental achievement of which was not just to make an adjustment of pre-existing institutions, but to wipe the slate clean and to reconstitute, to literally constitute a new world, to begin the world anew. And that's really the kind of the most important achievement, of which the American Revolution is the first of that revolutionary epoch stretching up to the 1840s, which is really wiping away all prior existing institutions. The whole state apparatus of the British Empire, just like the whole state apparatus of old regime France in 1789, in the whole state apparatus of the British Empire begins to be deconstructed and replaced. But it's not just replaced ad hoc, it's replaced on the idea of an objectified, written constitution, which provides a framework for a democratic republic of ever-expanding participation. And what I think people wrongly interpret the constitutional achievement as is they interpret it as like a straitjacket, where essentially you're held in place by some document, like, you know, Washington and Madison and Jay and all these guys, like Moses coming down from Mount Sinai, delivered the Ten Commandments and never can change. No, that's quite the opposite. These men of the Enlightenment, and women too in this process, believed above all in the fact the world could change, but that the world needed to be subject to self-conscious change, to people rationally and openly debating the fundamental principles of their society and setting up rules for how society changed itself. And so a constitutional republic was about setting down a framework with which everyone in society, even the illiterate, could know. There was no more arcani imperii. There are no more secrets of empire, secrets of the crown. Affairs of state are no longer the product of those noble of birth or blood, but are the product of anyone who can read or had read to them the principles of the framework of their polity, of their constitution. And thus, by having those principles read to them, those principles can then be subject to a reflective process of ever-expanding debate Are those principles right? Do those principles grant voting and powers to the appropriate amount of people? Should more people be included? Should they be changed? So really, constitutions were frameworks for societies to have a continual debate, critique, discussion about the nature of those societies themselves, and to make them susceptible to change without being destroyed or dissolving, if that makes sense. And so that was the greatest achievement of the American Revolution, and really set the stage for this revolution epoch, was the constitutional democratic republic that allowed people to, for the first time, understand the fundamental principles of their government so as to be able to subject those principles to an ongoing, never-ending discussion and debate.
Well, those are all things we'll have to consider on the next 4th of July as we as we commemorate our national holiday. Professor James Vaughan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Henry. I really appreciate the time.
And this has been another episode of 15 Minute History, and we'll see you next time.
You can find a transcript of this episode, along with supplemental documents, suggestions for further reading, and correlations to this Texas and National Educational Standards for History and Geography on our website, blogs.utexas.edu/15-minute-history. That's the numerals 15-minute-history. You can also find a link to suggest topics for upcoming episodes. The University of Texas at Austin is a free speech campus. Opinions and viewpoints expressed in episodes of 15-Minute History do not represent the official position of the University of Texas or of any of its colleges or departments. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.